Today, the Public Accounts Committee looks at tax evasion by HSBC, the bank that likes to say yes to Labour, the Tories and the Daily Telegraph. But after allegations of everything from torture to Secret Service child sex abuse to police killing to fraudulent Forex and LIBOR and discredited regulators, how corrupt is Britain? That's the title of a collection of papers edited by David White, professor in the Sociology, Social Policy and Criminology Department of the University of Liverpool. He joins me now. Welcome, David. So you say right at the beginning of the collection that corruption is construed as being in countries considered economically primitive. Yeah. Afghanistan, Russia, you mentioned. Is that a way of us being able to deal with it psychologically?
We have a national myth that's been there for a long time, which is that Britain is not corrupt, like those so-called primitive societies on the other side of the world, that Britain is more open, transparent, it has the checks and balances that make sure that our institutions don't go down the road of other less developed countries, and that we have no corruption. Quite clearly, even in the last 6 weeks, the cases that have risen to the surface show that our institutions have, across a whole range of different aspects of British public life, have a serious problem with corruption.
The Transparency International, albeit funded by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is mentioned in this book as one of the big five suspect companies, big auditors, we're only 14th in their list of 177 countries. We're doing well.
Well, one of the things the book does and has to do at the outset is to develop a critique of that index. And that index is based on subjective accounts, subjective interviews with experts and other members of the public and other people who are chosen for the index. So it's a very subjective account. And if you ask people in Britain generally, still, despite the constant reporting of cases in banking, you mentioned, and you mentioned the accountancy sector, across the corporate sector, across politics and across the police, despite this constant reporting of corruption, I think people are still a bit complacent in the UK about the corruption of British public life. And that's why we put the book together. That's why we're trying to kind of shift the debate a bit and look at Britain as a country which does have a corruption problem.
Like all good academics, you try and define your terms, and you seem to take issue with the most widely used definition of corruption, the World Bank's one, the abuse of public office for private gain. What's wrong with that?
Well, that definition, as most of the mainstream definitions of corruption, focus on bribery, individual bribery, and that doesn't necessarily capture the problem we've got in Britain. I'm not saying there's no corruption in Britain, of course. We know from coverage of the News International case, and also in the last couple of weeks of the Mirror Group case, which looks like these problems were even, if anything, deeper.
That case is currently going on, we should add.
Which is ongoing. And without drawing any conclusions about that, one of the main accusations about those cases was that there was bribery, was rife. Bribery was rife in the police and throughout those private companies. We know from about 2 months ago and even further, reports to the BBC from inside the Metropolitan Police about a lorry load of evidence about Met corruption that was shredded. And we know that from witnesses that much of that could have related to bribery. So I'm not saying there's no bribery in Britain, but the problem that we have is institutional corruption. Corruption for the benefit of institutions, where some individuals might gain, but it's not, you know, the problem of corruption we have is not about money changing hands to get people off parking tickets or police asking for bribes in the street. I think it's much more insidious, much more hidden, and in some ways, as we can see now from the daily press reports, much more extensive.
And there's some elements in some of the papers here talking about how corruption, as it were, is policed. I mean, there's one article talking about torture being endemic within British history, let alone today. Brunei to Aden to Ireland, Iraq to Kenya. Torture is even part of that corruption.
Look, there's a longer history of corruption in Britain and in every other Western democracy,
and
I might add,
that's
referred to, and it reforms today. What I think we need to think about in terms of this complacency, which is a historical complacency, I would say there's an almost racist assumption that Britain is not infected by corruption. And part of that is the way in which we assess and understand our liberal democracy and how it works. Now, the checks and balances that I mentioned earlier, if you look in terms of police corruption, we have the IPCC, which has been widely criticised in a number of cases that I won't go into. But if we just look at what the IPCC does, less than one in 400 cases of police corruption that are reported end up being investigated by the IPCC. So the discussion of corruption in the Met investigation that's going on now lies much more deeper and lies in a politics of impunity. If we look at the banking sector, I mean, the Serious Fraud Office, which does some excellent work, it only prosecutes about 20 cases a year. And you compare that to any other street crime, and it doesn't compare. There's around about 40,000 burglaries a year that end up in prosecutions, and yet we have the Serious Fraud Office funded to conduct 20 a year. So we have a problem with impunity. We have a problem with institutions that are not prepared and not able to hold the powerful to account, and that's really part of the history as well.
Does it infect the language that we use about it? Because again, British politicians would reply to you very quickly and say, yes, but it's worse elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I don't think these discussions are useful. If we take a historical perspective, right now, much more than ever before in this country, politicians' private links with private companies, whether that's while they're in office or after they're in office, are a matter of pride. They're something which they put on public record and boast about. They're not a matter of shame. They're not something that, as a culture, we say, why are particular politicians feather nesting, or why do they have particular interests? So I don't think we question enough the relationships that we find between those institutions that we're talking about. And one measure of that is without naming all of the cases we've seen in the last 6 months, but, you know, just to take a few, HSBC, you mentioned, the Bank of England itself under investigation for allegations of serious fraud. Tesco's undergoing its third investigation that was announced a couple of weeks ago. The cases in the police that we've talked about in politics. Why, with all of this building up, is corruption not the main issue in the British general election?
There are some answers offered in the book, because when Miliband and Cameron talk about corruption, they say, right, well, then we'll get a regulator to try and cope. I know you talk about the problems with regulators, but is there something wrong about the philosophy underlying it all, as it were? Because you mentioned privatisation, yeah, which seems so key.
Yeah.
It's not about these individual cases, and there is something inherently corrupt about a system which is obsessive about privatisation.
The first conclusion that the book comes to is that corruption in any given society is always related to how we constitute the public interest. So how policy and practice underpin what the public interest is, and when you have quite clearly systemic tax avoidance through various aspects of our financial system and nothing is done about it, then you have to say that there's a construction of the public interest which is very skewed.
So ahead of a general election, we can't debate it because the public interest isn't even mentioned.
Well, one of the things we would have to do if we wanted to debate it seriously would be to talk about the power that's concentrated in the City of London. And no one is taking on the City of London in advance of a general election. And probably for 3 to 4 decades now, we've had successive governments which have intensified the power and concentrated power in the City of London, and that there's no politician who seems to be brave enough to stand up, or political party to challenge that.
On that point, for those trying to seek less corruption in Britain and to break the power of a corrupt Britain, how will mass surveillance, the use of torture, the secret state, act against anyone trying to actually change things?
Well, look, we have to be a bit careful about the discussions about the secret state and the overpowering secret state. In all of the cases that we talk about in the book, there are social movements and there are organisations who have worked hard to uncover the problems that we're talking about and have done so collectively, collective movements. So if we're talking about tax evasion, we've got a chapter from someone from the Tax Justice Network there. We've got chapters from people involved in police monitoring groups. So for every problem of corruption
we're
that we
all
have...
alive as far as we
yeah,
know
Yeah, exactly,
moment.
Exactly. And actually, I think there is a growing movement. That's the point. There is a movement which is growing in strength, which is holding, particularly if you look at the way in which some community groups have emerged to hold the police to account around individual cases, like the Stephen Lawrence case, like the recent case, a series of cases around the Guardian journalist book, Undercover. There are a number of movements who are now beginning to work together and to look for community solutions to a problem that's undermining those communities, and that's across the board.
Professor David White, thank you.
Thank you.